From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, British Colonial History in the 17th Century. That's the topic this week on Soundings. My guests are Nicholas Canny of the National University of Ireland at University College Galway, and John Seeley of the University of Florida. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Nicholas Canny about his forthcoming study of 17th century Ireland and America in the English colonial system. Following that, a discussion with John Seeley about one of the notable symbols of English colonialism in the New World, Plymouth Rock. Here is Nicholas Canny.
Well, I suppose there is a general understanding that somewhere in the 12th century that there was an English involvement in Ireland associated with the Norman conquest, as it is known. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, I think that, again, there would be a popular understanding that somewhere in the 16th century, in the reign of Queen Elizabeth, that there was an intensification of English control and influence in Ireland. And again, proceeding forward into the 17th century, again, I think there's a popular perception of Cromwellian involvement in Ireland associated with bloodshed and massacre.
Let's talk about in comparative terms, Nicholas Canny. Our discussion is about the English colonial system in Ireland in the 17th century. What was going on elsewhere in the world that, for you as a historian, helps you to recreate the particular context that you're looking at? And understand it. For example, British participation, British colonization in the New World, yeah. in what is now the United States.
Well, one of the things that inspires me is one of the things that I think is important to emphasize in my work is to lay emphasis on the fact that at the same time as that there was substantial British involvement in Ireland, simultaneous with that you have the first sustained British involvement on mainland North America and in the islands of the West Indies also. That there had been some contact, of course, for a century before this, but it was primarily associated with fishing and that type of thing rather than actual direct sustained contact with the population of North America.
How do we measure this culturally? How do we figure out the impact of English colonialism in Ireland and in America? Do you look at elements like that? Is it important that we understand them?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, I've placed a lot of emphasis in my writing, and I will in the book that I'm now writing on also, on the extent to which English people particularly, and I'm speaking of English as opposed to Scots. Scots don't appear much in this aspect of my story, that English people had become very self-conscious of the fact that they were the conveyors of a very highly developed civilization, that they were conscious as Europeans that their society was a kind of an exemplary society, that somehow or other they had succeeded in escaping the turmoils that were tearing most other European societies apart. Mm-hmm. And again, looking at things from a British cultural perspective, while British tend to take a great deal of pride in the great literary and cultural achievements of the Elizabethan age and the Jacobean age, that some of their principal actors were also engaged in Ireland. For instance, one of my principal heroes or anti-heroes would be Edmund Spenser, except that Spenser was one of the great apologists for very draconian measures in the establishment of English authority in Ireland. And this is a factor which the writers of the English Renaissance tend to largely disregard.
Now, you're talking about the poet.
Edmund Spenser, that's right.
Be specific for me. What have you got in mind? Have you, lines from the Faerie Queen? What are you after here?
Well, the work that I principally concentrate on is the prose tract of Spenser, his view of the present state of Ireland, which is written in 1596, which is essentially a formula for colonization, more particularly colonization in Ireland, but the type of formula which was subsequently imitated by many of the English actors on mainland America, providing a rationale for treating an alien people as inferior and bringing them into an inferior position, theoretically, providing a formula for their gradual uplift. This was part of the formula of all colonization in the 17th century, and I would think that it is brought to its highest point and perfection in the writings of Edmund Spenser, that in that sense, while one mightn't always agree with what Spenser is saying or sympathize with what Spenser is saying, that you cannot but admire the consistency in his thinking and the wonderful simplistic formula which he's advancing for, as he would say, for uplifting an inferior people, which he sees as the justification of all colonization effort. But when you take account of this, you're seeing a negative side of the English Renaissance, which is frequently ignored by particularly, I think, literary writers. Again, another figure that I deal with is a man called Sir John Davies, who again was one of the great Jacobean poets, perhaps not one who is studied very frequently today, but who certainly enjoyed a great audience in the 17th century.
What did he do?
He wrote a lot of poetry, which was written, and much of it addressed to King James I, and which was greatly admired in Jacobean England, but at the same time he was the first English Attorney General in the once the English government has established its authority over all parts of Ireland in the 17th century, that he is largely responsible for the establishment of a framework of English law to be administered over all parts of Ireland. He was also engaged in the plantation of Ulster, and he carved out a substantial settlement for himself. But again, he was an apologist for colonization in Ireland, that while he was a lawyer, that he saw law as an instrument for advancing English civility over the barbaric conditions as he interpreted them, that he saw the other society as one which must be cast aside, and that he was the coiner of the phrase that within one generation there shall be no difference or distinction but the Irish sea between us, that Irish culture had to be abolished completely to make place for English civility and English civil standards in Ireland.
Nicholas Canny, we're talking about your project at the Humanities Centre, English Colonialism in the 17th Century. You're participating in a seminar here on the bicentennial of the American Constitution. Where are the overlaps? How do the two topics come together for you?
Yeah. Well, from what I've been saying so far, I've been drawing attention to the character of British settlement in Ireland in the 17th century. And I've been laying a good deal of emphasis on the English character of it. Mm-hmm. But it's important to recognize that while the actions were effectively determined by an English government, the legitimizations were advanced principally by English authors, that there was also a substantial Scottish migration into Ireland in the first half of the 17th century, and that this migration from Scotland primarily into Ulster was further strengthened at the end of the 17th century when the Scottish economy suffered a major collapse, essentially, and that there was a second substantial Scottish migration in particularly into the eastern parts of Ulster, although some of it scattered throughout Ulster as a whole. Some of them carried their dissatisfaction to the extent of not being satisfied to remain in Ireland, and that you have the beginning of a migration from Ireland to North America as you get into the 18th century. It's a sizable migration even as early as the 1720s, and it persists from the 1720s down to the decade of the American Revolution, and then once the revolution is through, it persists through the end of the 18th century into the 19th century.
All right, so we have a demographic contribution there in terms of population. What about in terms of ideas? That is to say, the political currents that the so-called founders picked up on that were making the transition back and forth across the Atlantic.
Yeah, well, the point that I was bringing out is that much of this Protestant population in Ulster is a dissatisfied population. Mm-hmm. It is dissatisfied particularly with what you might regard as Anglican or Episcopal establishments, and that these were a Presbyterian population who were never accepted as equals with the Protestant establishment who dominated government in Dublin. Mm-hmm. In that sense, they saw themselves as being excluded, and excluded even in many cases by their own landlords, who would have been Church of Ireland in religion rather than Presbyterian in religion.
And this has what, a sort of secular backfiring effect in the sense of setting up the American Constitution, what, so that it includes notions of tolerance, it includes notions of plurality. The very religious impulse that motivated these people, what, helped them to create a society in which everybody had an equal shot at religious practice.
Yeah, if you want to put it in positive terms, that you can say that these were a people who had a strong notion of equality, that all people, or certainly all Protestants, were equal or should be equal under the law.
All right, but
if you want to put it on a negative side,
right,
they were people who were totally intolerant of social elites. Social elites in terms of an established church. And you must see their position in Ulster as Presbyterians, that they were belong members of a church which hadn't full equality under the law. But they were also, and this is what they were particularly resentful of, they were required under the law to pay a tithe to an established church which they themselves didn't attend at all, and that the established church was the Church of Ireland, an Episcopal church. So that they paid voluntary contributions to their own clergymen so that they could have their own churches, but they at the same time had to pay, under the law, had to pay a tithe to an established church. And when they moved to America, they wanted none of that. They didn't want any establishments. Mm-hmm. And establishments were establishments associated with established churches established under the law. And they were also establishments associated with a wealthy landed elite dominating political life, that they would have challenged that right from the beginning and would have asserted their equality.
So it sounds as though they had we have it both ways, Nicholas Canny. We have in the establishment of the American Constitution, there is a landed elite. Those were the people who gave us the Constitution, in effect. And yet you have this enormous impulse fighting precisely against this notion of elitism. Have I got this right?
You can see that the formulation of the American Constitution was to a large extent, occurred because of the existence of dissident element within most of the colonies of America at that time. And a very substantial element of this dissident element were the people who had moved from the more settled coastal parts of the American states, as they were at this point, and moved into the more mountainous regions in the western parts of the state, and were regarded as a threat to the civil order which had come into existence.
You're talking about the origins of American individualism and the frontier spirit and independence, orneriness, for lack of a better word.
Well, that's where most of these settlers went. You can see it in the state of North Carolina, for instance, that the areas where Presbyterianism prevails today are mostly in the western part of the state, where you had a substantial Scottish element, and this element who were moving from Ulster, the Scottish-Irish element, as they're known as in American parlance, and that these were strong individualists, resentful of authority which was coming from the eastern part of the state, and that this challenge, which existed not only in North Carolina but in all of the other states as well, excessive individualism, as it would have been seen by the elite, is one of the factors which explains why they see the need of formulating a constitution in order to maintain order and discipline and a framework of government where limits will be established to people's rights, and that there certainly is this negative side to the formulation of the Constitution, that you have to determine where limits exist.
Nicholas Canny is a professor at the National University of Ireland at University College Galway. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Nicholas Canny is at work on a forthcoming book about 17th century Ireland and America in the English colonial system. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on 17th century English colonialism continues now with a discussion featuring a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center. John Seeley of the University of Florida is at work on a forthcoming history of one of the notable symbols of English colonialism in the New World, Plymouth Rock. Here is John Seeley.
Okay, now there are two dimensions of the rock's importance. The first is why the people in Plymouth, let us say, late in the 18th century, thought it was important.
That late compared to when it was... Okay.
That's right. They thought it was important because they assumed, because of attrition I'll fill you in on in a minute, that this was the point of landing for their pilgrim fathers. Mm-hmm. This was where they first stepped ashore in America.
Is that in fact the case?
That may be in fact the case. Mm-hmm. There is no historical substantiation of that at all. Uh-huh. There is no contemporary witness. As a matter of fact, as the citizens of Provincetown will tell you, the Pilgrims actually first set foot on the beaches of Provincetown. In fact, they spent a month exploring the Cape Cod coast, looking for a suitable place to settle. And it was only after about a month of such explorations that they finally came ashore at what we now call Plymouth. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was already called Plymouth on the maps. It hadn't yet been founded.
So what we have, John Seeley, is way, way back in our history, what Daniel Boorstin would call among the first of our pseudo-events.
Exactly. That is, there's no doubt that they came ashore there at Plymouth. It wasn't the first place they had come ashore. Yeah. And there is no account in the journals and the histories kept by Bradford, for example, people mm-hmm. who were there at the time, of any rock. Mm-hmm. They
okay,
just
so
talk about coming ashore.
Well,
all.
So when did the Plymouth Rock take on some historical importance? Well, both historical and literary importance.
Yeah. Well, the history begins with what we call a folk or oral tradition. Mm-hmm. There was an elderly man, Thomas Faunce, who was an elder in the church. He was in his 90s at the time, and he'd heard that there was to be a wharf built in Plymouth. Mm-hmm. Sticking out to in the sea, and that this wharf, which would be largely dirt fill, would bury this particular rock. Now, this is the only rock on Plymouth Beach. Please understand this. All the rest uh-huh. is sand, which is one reason that historians doubt that they ever stepped on that rock, because if you're in a small boat, a rock is not the thing you head for.
You want to go
there's lots
that.
Of so the sand, right. So he went down very agitated. In fact, he had to be carried down. He's very agitated, and he wept a bit, and he said that his father, who had been a boy during that period, had told him that this was the rock that the fathers first stepped upon.
Mm-hmm. So,
and so, but that was just kept within Plymouth folk. It wasn't reported in the papers, let us put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1774 or 1775, the accounts differ, but certainly in that revolutionary period, the Sons of Liberty were as busy in Plymouth as they were in Boston. They'd set up a Liberty Pole to rally around, and they decided it'd be a great idea to haul a rock up and put it next to the Liberty Pole. So they got to work with some jacks, and they had 20 yoke of oxen, and they pulled and heaved, and they managed to break the rock in two.
Oh, boy.
Some consternation, you can imagine. It was but that suggests by this time that there was considerable belief in Plymouth that this indeed was a sacred object or an icon, an image that meant a great deal to them locally. Well, two things happened. First of all, they said this was an omen. That is to say, this is the splitting away of the old country from the new.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So they took the upper half, presumably the new country, and they haul that into town and place it next to the Liberty Pole where it stayed for several decades.
All right. Now, John Seeley, you're working on a book on Plymouth Rock. Are you going to tell me that, somehow in our cultural patterns, we will find echoes of these historical or quasi-historical facts and acts and fictions? To what larger end are you working in writing about Plymouth Rock?
Well, as you might say, the largest end possible, that is to say, the Statue of Liberty.
Uh-huh.
That is to say, it seems to me that in terms of our national symbols, the rock has been, for all intents and purposes,
displaced
by the Statue of Liberty.
Okay.
And it's a long and very complex metamorphosis uh-huh. that led to that. But there are a series of images that I have found that seem to warrant that. But you have to remember that it took quite a while before the rock actually became a national figure. Even in 1774, you see it's largely the people of Plymouth celebrating their rock, which they called Forefathers Rock.
Okay,
they didn't call it Plymouth Rock.
And this national notion would have occurred when, in the 19th century?
Well, in 1820, to be exact.
Uh-huh.
Daniel Webster came to Plymouth in 1820 to give the 200th anniversary speech. You must remember we're talking about 1820 as opposed to 1620, the landing date. And on Forefathers Day, which was kept then erroneously on the 22nd of December, but that doesn't make any difference, one day error, Webster held forth with one of his first great speeches.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of public oration, not matched until his Bunker Hill speech in 1824, and it was a speech that really put Webster on the map as an orator. He was already well known. He had been an important lawyer, had pled before the Supreme Court. He was a congressman, and people knew who Daniel was. But he wasn't the godlike Daniel yet. He didn't have that ability to transcend the moment. Mm-hmm. But with this speech, he did. And he referred chiefly to the Pilgrims. After all, you cannot separate the rock from the Pilgrims or the Pilgrims from the rock. Mm-hmm. It's part of one unit. But he saw the Pilgrims coming to America as part of a sequential series of waves of progress. He went way back to the Crusades and brought it down to Plymouth, and then from 1620 on, he traced the waves of progress to the Mississippi, and then he saw it going on to the Pacific Ocean.
All right, well, let's bring our focal point more back to the rock, itself.
Yeah.
What has happened if the rock has been, as we said, displaced by the Statue of Liberty, if it's become simply another roadside attraction? What does that tell us about the way our ideas of our nationality, our liberty, for example, the creation, you know, of a new life in the new world, how have those things evolved?
Well, you have to, first of all, understand that, the rock takes its meaning from each decade. That is to say, Webster was a great apostle of progress, of national expansion, at the same time being a son of New England and a, at that point, still a Federalist, soon to become a Whig. He wanted to hold progress to the idea of New England, and therefore New England would be the great entry point by way of the rock. Everyone would come by way of the rock and head west, thereby carrying New England culture and institutions with it. But by 1850, the rock has pretty much become in control of what we would call the conservative factions of New England. Until in 1855, Wendell Phillips, the great abolitionist crusader, came to Plymouth. He was just to take part in a celebration. He wasn't the main speaker. William Seward, the great Whig, was to be the speaker. And Phillips merely was to respond to a toast to the pilgrims. And he used that occasion to radicalize the rock again, to bring it back to 1774. And he said at this one point, he said, this rock does not belong to Plymouth alone. He said, this rock just crops out here. It underlies all America. Just crops out here. It cropped out at Bunker's Hill. It cropped out. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence on it. In other words, he took it back into the radical camp.
All right, and how long did that sort of metaphorical approach last?
Not long.
And I take it that today the rock is on the decline, so to speak.
Well, it is, because by, let's say, the end of the century, it had become the property of a pretty desperate and embattled white Anglo-Saxon Protestant group. Say the old WASP, New England WASP, was pretty, becoming pretty desperate in terms of maintaining these hegemonies, maintaining its moral authority because of the increasing waves of immigration that had changed the population pattern.
Let me put it to you this way, John Seeley. Has Plymouth Rock ever as a symbol been enlisted by black Americans, by American Indian people, by women in American history?
No, as I say, it's
so
been,
this is testimony to what you're telling
me
about
this.
It's
pretty much been exclusively the property of the old New England establishment.
Yeah.
De Tocqueville, when he visited America in 1825, testified that this object was not only sacred in New England, but that Americans came and bore away pieces of it, like pieces of the True Cross. He said you could find them throughout America. That this was something that most Americans could relate to. My point is that following that period, it becomes increasingly the property of a conservative group. And by the end of the century, it is pretty much in the hands of what we would call diehard WASPs, if you want. In 1920, the speaker was Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts. Now, in 1820, Webster had projected and predicted that 100 years after his time, people would look back at Webster and his generation with the same kind of veneration and gratitude that Webster and his folks looked back at the pilgrims, seeing what they had accomplished. But that's not what happened. In fact, Lodge took Webster's speech as his text and pretty much blew Webster out of off the rock, as it were. He observed that Webster's generation believed in progress, and Webster was very much of that generation, but the First World War, and in fact the Civil War having intervened between that generation and Lodge's generation, he said, we no longer can believe in progress the way Webster did. Basically, he ends up by concluding that Webster is irrelevant. Now, if Webster is irrelevant, what does the rock stand for? Once you remove Webster from it and remove his, that progressive optimism, that belief in the march of progress forward, Webster becomes a sound and a fury, just empty noise.
So are you telling me what we can oversimplify enormously, that that this transition, this movement from Plymouth Rock to the Statue of Liberty represents what, the secularization of American society? Have we lost something in the equation here?
No, I think that what we're moving is from the specific to the general.
Okay.
That is to say, in specific, the forefathers, the pilgrims, if you want, came here to America for the specific liberty of practicing their faith.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time that Bertholdi built his great statue, by the time entering America was no longer associated with Boston or Massachusetts, but with New York Harbor and Ellis Island, you had wave after wave of people coming to America for whatever liberty. This mm-hmm. was the land of liberty. It could be the liberty of religion, the liberty of political choice, the liberty to find a better job, to improve your life, whatever. But as America as a symbol of freedom became very generalized.
Okay, so there has been a clear series of expansions and progresses,
which the Rock no longer can accommodate.
Uh-huh.
What I hope to show eventually is that, in a certain sense, it's the grand original, it's the seed, as it were, from which the notion of Plymouth Rock, the notion of the Statue of Liberty, comes. And in fact, the Statue of Faith is posed standing on the Rock.
Uh-huh.
But for the most part, as so far as I've been able to determine, the Rock figures in our art, it figures in our oratory, but not in our literature. Unless you want to believe my covert thesis that actually Moby Dick is about Plymouth Rock and that Melville's secret title was Moby Rock.
Now, come on, John Seeley, you're utterly putting me on with that one.
Well, yes, I am, but no, I'm not. That is to say, what I have found is that the Rock, like the whale, is to the beholder what the beholder sees.
It's inscrutable.
It is inscrutable. It's merely a rock, as mm-hmm. Melville says at one point. This is merely a whale. Mm-hmm. It's just a whale. But the beholders come to it, and what it is what they bring with them and impose upon it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a certain luxury of time and prosperity for people to begin to become nostalgic. And one of the great ironies is that the magnificent record of the Pilgrims is, of course, William Bradford's History of Plymouth Plantation,
right,
which is, for the most part, a lament about the loss of the original errand, that the sons of the fathers drifted away, began making money, no longer were interested in the great errand of the Pilgrims. And yet, 100 years later, when the sons of the sons of the sons began looking back, they saw their forefathers, Bradford and his generation, as at the start of a great experiment in human liberty and institutions, as the first bringers to America of America's great mission, which is not the way Bradford and his folk saw the errand.
John Seeley is a professor at the University of Florida. He's at work on a forthcoming history of Plymouth Rock. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, John Seeley worked on another forthcoming study in American cultural history entitled Beautiful Machine, Rivers and the Emerging Republic. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on 17th Century English Colonialism, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the topic will be sacred biography, saints and their biographers in the Middle Ages. My guest will be Thomas Heffernan of the University of Tennessee. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for conversations about two aspects of British colonial history. Nicholas Canny of the National University of Ireland will discuss 17th century Ireland and America in the English colonial system. And John Seeley of the University of Florida talks about one of the notable symbols of English colonialism in the New World, Plymouth Rock. Aspects of British Colonialism, the topic this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.